When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Everyone has a breaking point. You and I have one. Michael Phillips has reached his. Very obviously, he has gone insane.
Yes, sir. Very much so, sir. Obviously insane.
Your mission is to proceed up the Nung River in a Navy patrol boat. Pick up Colonel Kurtz's path at New Mung Ba. Follow it. Learn what you can along the way. When you find the colonel, infiltrate his team by whatever means available. And terminate the colonel's command.
Terminate Phillips?
He's out there writing reviews without any decent restraint, and it will help prepare you for this week's top five, Dangerous Missions.
Is this in my contract?
Always read the fine print, Larson. Our Dangerous Missions top five is inspired by Matt Damon in Elysium. Our review is after the break.
The horror! The horror!
That's Phillips' entire review of We're the Millers, by the way.
Terminate with extreme prejudice, Josh. It's all ahead on Film Spotting.
Film Spotting is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals.
For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting. If you're not sure what to choose when you get there, later in the show, we'll offer a few audiobook recommendations of books being turned into movies that are coming soon to a theater near you, including The Wolf of Wall Street by Jordan Belfort, narrated by Bobby Cannavale. You're listening to Film Spotting. Josh and I have 1 hour to complete our top five dangerous missions, or else microscopic explosives will rupture our carotid arteries.
You do realize this show is never just an hour.
Talk fast.
But first, our review of Elysium.
I need to get to Elysium.
Whoever has this has the power to override their whole system.
Hey, bring down the boom saw!
This ain't gonna kill me.
You can save everyone.
We're gonna break into the most heavily guarded place in the universe.
Oh, yeah.
Writer-director Neil Blomkamp loves to run his heroes through the ringer of a really bad day. Get promoted in the morning, like Charlton Copley's bureaucrat Vicus does in Blomkamp's 2009 debut District 9. By lunchtime, you'll get a strange alien fluid sprayed in your face. By suppertime, you'll almost have fully mutated into one of the persecuted creatures you'd just been anointed to evict and relocate. Get accosted without cause by robo-police en route to your factory job, as Matt Damon's ex-con Max is in Blomkamp's latest Elysium, set in 2154 L.A. By lunchtime the next day, you'll be exposed to a lethal dose of radiation, and by suppertime, I don't know, you might be doing desperate things like having a transmitter implanted in your brain, then trying to smuggle data from a prominent businessman in order to punch your ticket to a space station where all of your medical problems will be magically cured. Basically, nobody should go to work in a Neil Blomkamp film. Also linking the two films are the lines drawn between the higher and lower classes and the parallels to real-life economic and cultural struggles. In District 9, the alien creatures are referred to as prawns and segregated into their own dilapidated, dirty section of Johannesburg. In Elysium, the downtrodden 99% are all stuck on the overpopulated Earth, while the 1%ers live a life beyond mere luxury in the sky. There's no poverty or disease or conflict or wanting of any kind. just a perpetual state of being at a swanky party in the Hamptons. Now, Josh, back in 2009, your predecessor, Maddie, and I frustrated a lot of film spotting listeners by liking District 9, but not liking it enough. We had issues, especially with the action-packed third act. A look back at my notes reveals phrases like a lot of explosions, becomes redundant, near-miss escapes, different people putting aside issues and developing a bond, cliches. Wish it could have better integrated the action with the socio-political stuff. And finally, is it all just a tease, a provocative but mostly abandoned setup for the action? That's the question, Josh, I pose to you now about Elysium.
I didn't like District 9 enough either, actually. I was accused of that too. I did like it, but I had some problems with it, similar problems. I rewatched it recently, and I wouldn't say I was wrong earlier, but those problems bothered me a lot less the second time around. I think I was a little hard on the film. Elysium has some of the same problems, for sure. Those were your notes from District 9 you were quoting from?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they could easily be notes from Elysium, I think. I think District 9 is the better film in the end, though they are both similar. And that's largely because District 9 wasn't like, you know, a no-budget indie. But compared to Elysium, it certainly had this sense of shagginess that Elysium has a big star. It's got Damon. It's got the big budget. Much more sophisticated effects, and that weighs it down a little bit. And the socio-political stuff is much more deftly handled in District 9 as well, I'd say. It's a little heavy here, but what both movies do so well, and the reason why I still went for Elysium, was create this vision of the future that is fully lived in, fascinating to observe. And I just wanted to keep watching and see what else they imagined things might be like. Here, a lot of them, it's a downer, you know, like a lot of dystopian sci-fi films are. So it's not exactly exciting in that way. It can be a little bit frightening, even some of the things they envision here. But this picture of future Los Angeles, the dustiness, the dryness of it, the levels of this shanty town that Damon lives in and his work day that you talk about. I could just watch this go on. And there's so many great details. And I'm just going to throw one out there. He has to report as an ex-con to a parole officer. And the parole officer is an android, pretty much an animatronic figure. It's not quite a robot. It's fixed there on a desk. Looks like a civil servant. And Damon has to go and report there.
Hello. Before we start, I'd just like to explain...
Max DaCosta, violation of Penal Code 2219, today at bus stop 34B.
Yes, that's exactly what I wanted to talk to you about. You see, I believe there's been a misunderstanding.
Immediate extension of parole by a further 8 months.
Wait, what? No. I can explain what happened. I was made a joke, and, you know...
Stop talking. Elevation and heart rate detected. Would you like a pill?
No.
It can detect by his tone of his voice how he's doing, and it's not helpful at all. And the detail I love there is how this animatronic figure has graffiti scrawled all over his face. So you just know that's how you build this world out. You know that this isn't a one-time thing just built for Damon to talk to. This thing has been interviewing dozens and hundreds and years probably of parolees who have gotten so frustrated. Something like that just fills it in so wonderfully. Elysium is full of that sort of stuff. It really allowed me to overlook what are some major problems that I'm sure we will get to in the film.
Well, we do agree on one thing, that is District 9 is the better movie. Our issue is going to be over how much better we think District 9 is. We also agree, Josh, on the visual touches that we get with this film that make this world fascinating, at least on first glance, at least on its most superficial level. I like those same elements, and I see where you're going. But for me, unfortunately, none of that was enough to compensate for the really, really bad, in my mind, storytelling that we get here. And comparing it to District 9, it has all the same third act problems, but expands them to the second and parts of the first act as well. And District 9 followed through a lot more on its premise. It actually seemed interested in exploring some difficult questions. That's why that second act was better. But it's all just background here for me, Josh. That's the way it seemed. The story is all way too clunky and cumbersome. So much tedious cause and effect plotting that it was impossible for me to ever really get lost in the world the way I did with District 9 and the way it seems you did with this film as well. And we're going to get in more specifically to some of the storytelling elements that really rubbed me the wrong way. But I got to start with an obvious issue with this film. And there are a couple performances, a couple characters, and the way they're envisioned that were an issue for me. But Jodie Foster, I know she doesn't have a huge role in this film, but it's substantial enough.
When it's this poorly done, it feels bigger.
So we agree on that.
Yeah.
As well.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
I saw the trailer, though I don't remember actually seeing her talk in it. I must have just seen glimpses. I knew she was in the movie.
I don't think she does talk, and I think there's a reason for that in the trailer.
Yeah. I knew she was in the film, and I knew she must have been playing an authoritarian-type figure. And I knew that it was this sci-fi future world, so she might feel the need to make it into a character. And I thought she might go back to that same character she plays in Inside Man, which is a movie I really like, the Spike Lee film. But again, it's that kind of overly cultured, sophisticated, better than anyone else, rich snob that she's playing. And I thought, okay, please tell me that she's not just going to fall back on that same kind of approach, the overly twitchy, obviously evil, over-enunciating everything again. Please tell me that's not what she's going to do with this movie. And Josh, of course, the first moment she appears on screen, that's exactly what she fell into. And honestly, for me, the most pleasure I got watching this film was watching really good, much more subtle actors like William Fichtner, who plays Carlyle. He's the big businessman that becomes a target for them and does play a key role in the film ultimately. And Ferran Tahir, who doesn't play a key role at all. He's supposedly the president of Elysium, and that's totally wasted. But watching those two actors act opposite her, and every time it would cut to one of their close-up reaction shots where they were silent, I would just start inserting my own thought bubbles. I wasn't thinking about the characters at all and how they were reacting. I was thinking about what the actors were thinking and how they were reacting as they're watching Jodie Foster put on this Cruella de Vil show, because that's what it seems like she's doing. And I just couldn't imagine how hard it was for them to not break and just start laughing or stare at her in bemusement every time she opened her mouth. I understand that Cate Blanchett and Rachel Weisz aren't always going to be available, unfortunately. And I like Foster.
I don't think it's a matter of is the talent there, though. I mean, clearly Foster has proven that
she's
had it.
I'm starting to wonder. She's a really talented actress.
I'm starting to wonder if working with actors is, at this point in his career, not a strength of Blomkamp's. Because you look back even on District 9, and people fell in love with the Copley character, the hero there. But it's a very, especially on a second look at that, it's a very broad comic performance.
Yes.
There's not much nuance there, even considering the journey that character takes. In this film, I don't know. I mean, Fichtner is fine. I don't think the president registers much at all. Other than Damon, who I think is pretty good.
He is.
This is full of bad performances, actually.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of the gangster leader that Damon has to team up
Spider.
With. That was Spider.
And I didn't
played
really
by,
mind him for some reason.
Oh, he was so abrasive. Wagner Moura. And that was just a screaming pitch performance. And I'm just wondering if this is something that, you know, even if the actors have talent, they've got to be directed in the material they're in well, and Blomkamp doesn't seem to be doing that in either of these
two
films.
No, he lets Jodie Foster just run roughshod over his film, and I was going to say she's one of those actresses that just shouldn't be trying to play capital C characters, but I don't think this character needed to be portrayed that way from the beginning, and I'm not sure why she is. And we should say the character she's playing is basically the Secretary of Defense. She's like the
right.
Minister of Homeland Security on this space station called Elysium. She's there to protect their way of life. But for me, it was a case where every time I watched her, it was as if the character knew that she was in a sci-fi movie and had to somehow behave in an elevated way.
She's so blatantly allegorical too, right?
Yeah.
That's part of the problem, which is another weakness of this movie, is it plays the, it's not necessarily a terror parable as much as an immigration debate parallel is what I found.
Absolutely.
And she is being this villain who just wants to shut down the borders. I mean, there's not really much for her to work with.
There isn't.
And I, like I said, the allegory doesn't work too well. In District 9, it was woven in a little bit better. And here we get that early sequence of these three space cruisers, refugees really, trying to break into Elysium, and Foster's character tries to prevent them. That's almost like a 10-12 minute, here's our allegory. This is what the movie means to be about. And then we move on to the narrative proper with Damon. It's a very odd structure.
It is. Yeah.
But I still think the movie works because that's the surface allegory it's going for. It doesn't spend all that time on it except for that segment and the scenes with Foster's character. You said it's working on a superficial level, these details of building the world.
I don't mean that as a pejorative. I mean, just at first glance, the things that you need to make a movie work, it's got to at least get those right. And
right.
This movie does.
And I guess what I'm saying is it's getting those right, and they matter below that surface level, though, because there's a lot of interesting stuff here to me about technology specifically, looking ahead at what sort of technology we have now. They tweak it. We've talked about how the best future movies just tweak the present. They don't launch us into some crazy town.
Yeah.
And they tweak so much stuff here, from prosthetic limbs, this exoskeleton.
It feels believable. You say, yes,
Damon,
I can see the future becoming
this. And it's integral to the story, too, and how it's changing the Damon character, where he has these prosthetic limbs and he has this ability. He essentially becomes a Dropbox where all this information can be dropped into his head. I mean, Google Glass, that's kind of taken a few degrees further in this film. And it's a very disconcerting underbelly to this movie, watching this sort of technology play out in a level where it's just insidious. It's at once the savior for the character that we're rooting for in this movie, and also his curse. I found all of that to be pretty interesting.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the new film from District 9 director and writer Neil Blomkamp. It's called Elysium, starring Matt Damon. And we're agreeing a lot, even though I think we do have a pretty vast difference in the way we view this film, even though I'm with you on the technology as well. As I was saying, that is the best aspect of any sci-fi futuristic movie. Looper did this in spades as well.
Very good
where
comparison.
You start to immediately recognize the real world in the future, and you can identify with it and start to make sense of it. I think that is a strength here. But there are so many weaknesses here, including going from Jodie Foster, a badly conceived performance, to what I would say is a badly conceived character from the start. Maybe, for me, Josh, I'm trying not to be too hyperbolic here, maybe the most poorly conceived character I've seen on screen all year, and that's the character Charlton Copley plays, Kruger. He's like this bounty hunter, federal agent, former federal agent who's gone rogue. He's kind of like one of those Bourne agents that they ring on his wristwatch, whatever, and they say, we need you to go take out a target. That's what he does here in this movie. But his character, Kruger, is so absurd and goofy, I think you said broad, that's definitely accurate, that he's never actually, for me, scary or intimidating. And he's so clearly just a screenwriting construct to serve one purpose. He's there to be the antagonist for our hero. He's there to make Matt Damon's mission difficult. And then on top of it, Josh, did you notice that they introduce an element to his character, which is that he's a convicted rapist? And if you think about it in the context of the film and how it works overall, they really introduce that element just so we'll accept why he chooses to take a woman hostage, because the plot needs the woman to have a ride to Elysium. And then we have to suffer through multiple scenes with the threat of rape looming. And that's really distasteful stuff. And everything about his character is distasteful.
It's actually unnecessary.
It's totally unnecessary.
I mean, it does get her on the ship, like you're saying, but there would be easier ways to do that.
There would be. And so not one moment with Copley's character brought me any kind of enjoyment with this movie, including watching him blowing up people left and right. And then after he's done, saying lines like, that's what I'm talking about. This movie is smarter than that, or should have been smarter than this.
Copley gives a bad performance in all of those ways, but the character, I think you're throwing out the entire character in a way that's a little bit dismissive, because it does tie back to what I did find interesting about it, was this idea of technology, because Copley is not just a mercenary. He's very much tied to the weapons he uses. Now, this is another problem with Blomkamp's films a little bit, in they straddle that line between glorifying weapons and satirizing them.
Okay.
And it often happens in the same scene. You're not quite sure which way it's going. But here, Kruger's character is very much defined by the weapons he uses and how they compare to Damon's character and the weapons that he not only uses, but that he adopts, that he allows to be built into him. And so there are these twin poles here of how you can use technology. And that's why the Kruger character is essential. For the climax, it comes after he has been built onto even more.
But did that really
to
interest
adopt
you?
It did,
you
very
found that
much so, because it's the same journey that Damon's character has been taking.
It's thrown
and
on,
so there
Josh,
are
just
two
so
different ways. It's
fight.
Not thrown on.
It's there
it
just
starts,
to be a bigger
well, of
fight.
Of course, there's that element to
well,
it.
That's not interesting.
But it starts from the very beginning. It's just not haphazard. Oh, now let's throw this outfit onto him.
That's kind of how it
are,
seemed to me.
Not at all. Weapons are used progressively, and there are different ones introduced. And every time that Kruger uses it, it's to increase power and to subject dominion over someone else. And everything that Damon takes on could do that. It does have that capability, but it also has this other power of sacrifice and helping others and being in a way to the service of a larger community. So you have two opposite poles here. And I thought they developed that pretty well all the way to the final scene.
That's a really nice reading, and it's a really generous reading, and I almost buy it. I really almost do,
Josh. Just buy it.
Ultimately, all this film is interested in, this is my biggest issue with the film, and we've hinted at it a little bit along the way, but it's all the distractions. You talked about that scale where we get that sense of the glorification of violence and these weapons mixed with the satirizing. I would say the scale is tipped here way in favor of the glorifying, and you take such a great concept. All this social, political, and cultural relevance this movie has. You mentioned immigration. There's no doubt about it. Healthcare, class warfare that's relevant today. Everything that could sideline this great concept does ultimately with this film. The actions, the fights, the chases, faces getting blown off, watching people we don't care about and don't even need to see die. Like knowing that they're dead actually doesn't serve the story in any way at all. We have to see them die, and not only die, die in gruesome cool ways that I think are there really to just give you this sense of shock and awe. And Blomkamp lingers on these things. He chooses to focus on those things, and he stays on them.
He's a splatter filmmaker.
Yeah, he really
is. District 9 was supported by Peter Jackson, who made very similar films early in his career, where part of the gag, if you will, is seeing this sort of gore and this sort of destruction. And that's something we have to wrestle with in a lot of our movies, is where are we going to draw the line for these sort of things? Mm-hmm. I guess for me in Elysium, I didn't find it to go to that extent where it was reprehensible. I mean, the whole rape thread that you're talking about was probably the most troublesome thing to me in the movie, not some of these things you're talking about.
I think all the really interesting stuff is just backdrop here. It gives this movie this patina of profundity that Blomkamp clearly just doesn't care to actually explore or even play with for me in a meaningful way. And that's really frustrating. I had made a joke about this film on Twitter, and one of our followers said, ultimately, I'd rather see swings and misses like this than bunts like Iron Man 3, Star Trek Into Darkness, and Man of Steel. I haven't seen Man of Steel, so I can't comment on that specifically, but typically I'd agree with that assessment. I'm one who will applaud noble movies that maybe don't quite pull off what they're going for versus movies that work but play it really safe. But unfortunately for me, Josh, this isn't even a bunt. It's not even a swing and a miss. This is a strikeout looking with the bases loaded in the bottom of the ninth. Blomkamp sets the stakes so high here, and I love that aspect of this film, but then he seems content to just watch the pitch go by. That actually depresses me more than movies that play it safe, movies that have so much potential to say something really interesting and still be action-packed and be entertaining, but settle for the lowest common denominator. And that's what I think this movie does.
I don't think it's settling. I think he hasn't quite mastered how to weave in the allegory with the action.
I
think that's something that, for whatever reason, his first film did do a little bit better. And here it's much more of a struggle. So a swing and a miss, I mean, I think it's more than that, but I don't think it's settling at all. I don't think that's a fair characterization. No,
okay.
I mean, otherwise, if you're settling, you don't bring this much stuff into it. I mean, another problem is that he is bringing on way too much. It's very much overly plotted. I would agree.
Yeah.
That's a sign of ambition to me, of an attempt to do something that you don't pull off, then settling. And so, I mean, Iron Man 3, that just kind of settles to me. That falls into that category. This is, I'd say, a swing and a good enough hit.
We could certainly go on. I know I could wax on about all of the plot elements that drove me absolutely crazy and all the questions about this film that make absolutely no sense. We could talk about the terrible flashbacks that we get in this movie that are what Blomkamp apparently thinks he needs to use to set up any kind of emotional resonance that the film otherwise doesn't have at all. But we won't, Josh, unless you want to battle me on that.
Unless you just fit all those things in right there.
Basically what I was doing. How about that? Elysium is out now in wide release, been out for a couple weeks. If you've had a chance to see it or do catch up with it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744. You can also find us on Twitter @filmspotting and facebook.com/filmspotting.
Massacre Theater is next, with a scene chosen only hours before we hit the studio. Adam, you know I require at least 3 days of rehearsal.
Especially with these accents.
I'll also share my thoughts on the aptly named The Spectacular Now. Stay with us.
To the misanthropic, misbegotten merchants of gloom, who look into their crystal balls and prophesy our doom, let the death knell chime. It's the end of time. Let the cynics put their blinkers on and toast our decline. Don't become demoralized by this chorus complaint. It's a sure sign that the old world is terminally quaint. And tomorrow's gonna be a better day. Ooh. matter what the siren voices say, tomorrow's gonna be a better day. We're gonna make it that way.
Hey everyone, a quick interruption to remind you that this episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment, providing digital versions of tens of thousands of audiobooks for download to your computer, your iPhone, your Android phone, BlackBerry, and iPod. Listen whenever and wherever you want, just like the podcast you're listening to right now. Audible has more than 100,000 titles to choose from in every genre.
The last time we featured an Audible recommendation, Josh, it was a huge success. I promoted the Reza Aslan book, Zealot, about the life of Jesus, and after that, suddenly
it just exploded.
It was number two on Amazon.
Nothing to do with that Fox News interview.
Nothing at all.
Did you also happen
to see
Film
Spotting bump?
Yeah, sure. Did you also happen to see him quoted in Time Magazine, his opinion of Argo?
Yes, Josh, I did happen to see
that. Okay, I just wanted to point you in that direction.
Yeah, and now I have to discredit everything I thought about Reza Aslan. No, you're right. That was a good interview, and I did see that comment. As promised, some recommendations of books that are coming out soon in movie form. I don't know why I'm recommending these, Josh, because it violates all my principles, as you know. I do not believe that you should read the books before going to see the movies if you really care about the movies, because it is going to completely ruin your experience, more or less. You're going to be thinking about the book the whole time, but I couldn't resist it here because there are some really interesting-looking movies that are coming out that are in book form and available now via Audible, including Captain Phillips. This is the account of the first American cargo ship to be hijacked in 200 years. It stars Tom Hanks. I have to say, Josh, I saw the trailer for Captain Phillips, and while it looks like a pretty good film, I was really disappointed to see that it was called Captain Phillips.
Yes, I agree with you on that.
Really?
I don't know if I was disappointed or kind of confused. Like, that is this a working title?
I like the book title better, A Captain's Duty.
Yeah.
Full title, Somali Pirates, Navy SEALs, and Dangerous Days at Sea by Richard Phillips and Stephen Talty. It's narrated by George K. Wilson. Why couldn't they go with A Captain's Duty instead of Captain Phillips?
Even Somali Pirates.
I
could have gone that way.
That's better. You also have 12 Years a Slave, a movie we are both really excited about. It stars Brad Pitt and Chiwetel Ejiofor. That book by Solomon Northup is available now on Audible. It's narrated by the great Louis Gossett Jr. I did mention The Wolf of Wall Street at the top of the show. This is the new film from Martin Scorsese starring Leonardo DiCaprio. That book by Jordan Belfort is also available on Audible.com, and it's narrated by another great actor, Bobby Cannavale. Finally, I don't know if we'll see the biopic Job starring Ashton Kutcher, but if you want all the background, and this was a big bestseller, so many of our listeners probably already did read it or listen to it, but the Walter Isaacson biography of Steve Jobs, called Steve Jobs, is out on Audible, and it's narrated by, I'm getting redundant here, a great actor, Dylan Baker.
They tend to pick those great actors for these jobs, yeah.
You can always send us your own Audible recommendations, email feedback@filmspotting.net, or post them on the Film Spotting Facebook page. That's facebook.com/filmspotting. We might just feature one of your picks on a future segment.
For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting. That's audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting.
To the pessimistic populists who harbor no doubt that every day we make our way to hell in a handcart.
Lisa P's back! Lisa P? Did you hear that?
Lisa P's back!
Man, it's
the
same. Come on.
Lisa P's back!
I'll make you a star.
Freddy, Freddy, Lisa P's back!
Yeah, who's Lisa P?
Your mother of crap, who's Lisa P?
That's Lisa P.
Come on.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. That's Jesse Eisenberg as James and Martin Starr as Joel in the 2009 Greg Mottola film Adventureland, a summer movie if there ever was one, a movie set in the 80s, as I recall, Josh, and that does set up nicely the Film Spotting poll question this week as we reflect on summer movies and look ahead to next week's discussion of the new David Gordon Green film, Prince Avalanche, a movie that takes place in the summer of 1988. That poll question coming here in a moment. Right now, though, it's time for Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, Adam and I massacred this.
This stuff is great, but it's like lead.
So tell me, where have you been? I haven't seen you. I haven't even...
You haven't even called or anything. Where have you been?
Well, Mom, I've been working nights.
And?
Well, tonight we were out late. We took a ride on the out to the country, and we hit one of those deers. I tell you, where the blood came from. I told you. Jimmy told you before, I won't say. Anyway, you know what reminds me? I need this knife. I'm going to take this. It's okay?
Okay, yeah.
I just need it for
bring
a little
it back, though, you know.
Well, the poor thing, you know, we got... I hit him in his... we hit the deer in his paw. What do you call it?
The paw.
The hoof got caught in the grill. Oh. I gotta hack it off.
Ooh.
Ma, it's a sin. You gotta leave it there, you know. So, anyway, I'll bring your knife back if they do that. Anyway.
Delicious. Delicious.
Thank you. Why don't you get yourself a nice girl?
I get a nice one almost every night, Ma.
Yeah, but get yourself a girl so you could settle down. That's what I mean.
I settle down almost every night, but then in the morning I'm free. I love you. I wanna be with you.
Why don't you settle down?
That was Joe Pesci as Tommy, Robert De Niro as Jimmy, and Catherine Scorsese as Tommy's ma. She would also be Scorsese's mother. Director of Goodfellas, of course, is Martin Scorsese, written by Scorsese and Nicholas Pileggi, based on his book.
Andy Friedman wrote in, I knew right from the beginning that you were doing that classic scene from Goodfellas where Pesci, De Niro, and Liotta's characters stop at Pesci's mother's house on their way to bury Billy Batts, grab a kitchen knife without waking her up, but end up being guilted into having full-on spaghetti and meatballs with her. They get to banter for a while in what seems not at all like acting, but just the actors playing themselves. One thing I always notice is when they take a few moments to debate whether it's called a paw or a hoof while they're killing time trying to explain what they're doing there. It's just so natural and lived in. I do agree with Andy on that. He says the tie-in is clearly Adam's use of Pesci in his top five list of supporting actors in lead roles. I did have Pesci from My Cousin Vinny on that top five, and I did mention this role specifically. But Andy says it also ties in with the review of Woody Allen's Blue Jasmine, which we discussed on our last show. What two directors are more associated with capturing New York City perfectly than Scorsese and Allen? Even better, their visions are both complementary but completely different. I believe that Scorsese has said of Allen's films that they see in New York that his movies don't show.
That does sound familiar.
Good tie-in.
Thomas Pashko from Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, had this to say about our performances. I thought after last week's massacre of Short Circuit, Josh had hit an all-time high or low. In his tenure as one of the Massacre Theater players, the shrill, choppy performance as a robot was a truly transcendent bit of bad acting. I was willing to believe that such a level of bad acting could never be duplicated or surpassed. Then you guys did Goodfellas. Was Josh trying to do Joe Pesci? I've got to commend him for really committing and going for it, but ultimately it sounded like a jumpy tweaker receiving electroshock therapy while simultaneously being used as a human craps table during the casino's busiest weekend.
I don't even know what that means, but it's gold.
I think that's more how Pesci is in that Lethal Weapon movie, actually.
Yeah, you're right. Todd Stevens from Chicago also commented on your performance, Josh. If we can call it that, I will be shocked if this isn't one of the top three most entered Massacre Theaters ever. It was not. It's not even in the top 10.
No.
Shocked by that as well, despite the fact that Josh just recycled his Chucky impression to play Tommy DeVito. I guess that's just his default voice for short psychopaths.
Is Todd implying that I don't have a range?
That's exactly what he's saying. You
how
basically
you,
did
Todd.
Go to your Child's Play scene for that. You drew on
we
your
did Child's Play,
past
huh?
performance of
oh,
Chucky.
Okay.
Well, whatever works for you, Josh. You got to do what you got to do. Some people have method acting. You have Chucky. If you want to hear Josh's Joe Pesci by way of Chucky and our discussion of Blue Jasmine and our top five supporting players in lead roles, you can get that show at filmspotting.net or via iTunes. It also features my interview with James Cromwell, a great longtime supporting character actor who gets a lead role in his new film, Still Mine, which he's very, very good in. It is not one of the most entered ever, Josh, but there were a lot of entries. The hat's brimming. You reach into that film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
The winner is Marcus Jokes from Washington, D.C.
I know D.C. well. Just got back from a little vacation there. Unfortunately, did not get to meet Marcus. But Marcus will still hook you up with your six-month subscription to Fandor.com. Just email feedback@filmspotting.net.
That was the greatest acting I have ever seen.
I just don't know how you do it, Gary. How do you make yourself so somber and emotional to make everybody cry like that?
It's not that hard, really. I just think about the saddest moment in my life.
We'll see what descriptions people come up with for this week's performance of Massacre Theater. It's presented by Fandor.com.
A site to discover, explore, and share independent foreign and classic cinema. More information at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Help support the show by signing up now. Film Spotting listeners get the first 30 days free.
And tying in with our summer theme as we talk about our poll and Prince Avalanche, which we're set to discuss next week, you can check out on Fandor their spotlight on summer movies. Great film, Slacker. And while I can't say it's a great film, it's Climates. It's the film from the Turkish filmmaker Nuri Bilge Ceylan. He's a favorite here of ours just from his recent film Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, but Climates is a film that I know Michael Phillips, among many other critics, is a huge fan of, and that's one you can see right now on Fandor. Quick correction as well, I do want to throw out there for our very discerning listeners who caught this on our last show. I promoted Neighboring Sounds, a recent Brazilian film, which you can see on Fandor. I think I referred to it as a documentary. It is a narrative film. So that correction is made. Film Spotting regrets the error. Let's move on to the scene, Josh. And we can say, even though nothing in the dialogue suggests it, it does tie in with our top five theme this week.
Correct.
Dangerous Missions. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
We'll see. You started off, so I'm going to give you the action. And action.
One day, lad, all this will be yours.
What? The curtains?
No, not the curtains, lad. All that you can see, stretched out over the hills and valleys of this land. This will be your kingdom, lad.
But mother...
Father, lad, father.
But father, I don't want any of that.
Listen, lad, I built this kingdom up from nothing. When I started here, all was swamp. Other kings said I was daft to build a castle on a swamp, but I built it all the same, just to show 'em. It sank into the swamp. So, I built a second one. That sank into the swamp. So, I built a third one. That burned down, fell over, and then sank into the swamp. But the fourth one stayed up. And that's what you're going to get, lad. The strongest castle in these isles.
But I don't want any of that. I'd rather...
Rather what?
I'd rather just sing. And...
I would love to let you go on, actually.
Oh, the world does not need to hear that. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, August 19th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Over to the driving range and hit a few virtual balls in space.
Nah, we did that yesterday. I don't want to do that.
Well, then what do you want to do?
I don't know. Something. Wow.
A clip there from the great Pixar film WALL-E, tying in with Elysium, which we knew on our last show we were going to be discussing this week, Josh, and that helped set up one of our most depressing film spotting poll questions ever. We thought about the end of the world. The Earth, as we know from our review of Elysium, has become a giant overpopulated slum. The rich have left it for space. So if we all assume it's a matter of time, the human race is done for, how do you think our collective end is going to go down? And we came up with some movie tie-ins here to your choices. But basically, we're asking you to really get scientific and ponder our demise, which, I don't know, that's not that much fun, but we did it anyway.
See, people seem to like doing that. I mean, we got a lot of good responses.
We got a lot of comments and a lot of votes. Your options were extinction via global female infertility, children of men, oil supplies depleted, motorcycle gangs roaming the land, looting and killing, Mad Max, of course, or nuclear holocaust, apes take over, Planet of the Apes, machines, maybe they become self-aware, wipe out humanity or enslave it, that's Terminator, The Matrix, or maybe it is like WALL-E, the Earth is overrun with garbage and the humans evacuate. You do have the final option, the ice caps melt, survivors live on ships and drink their own urine. Wow, we had to get that graphic there. That's Waterworld, the great Kevin Costner classic. How did it come out, Josh?
Well, here are the two at the bottom that people aren't too worried about. They're not worried about nuclear holocaust and the apes taking over, only 6%.
Well, they didn't see Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Believable. It was convincing. Nobody's too worried about extinction via global female infertility either. Children of men received 9% of the vote. In the middle here, drinking urine, probably not going to happen, people said. 17% for Waterworld. Mad Max with oil supplies depleted. I'm surprised this didn't win it, but 18%. Here at the top, our top two, machines become self-aware, wiping out humanity or enslaving it. The Terminator Matrix pick.
And it goes back to your take on Elysium. It's
little
all about
bit.
Technology.
Well, 20% of the people do fear that. But the winner is that Earth will be overrun with garbage and humans evacuate. WALL-E, 30%.
You know, I did question the thinking, the rationale behind this poll question last week on the show. I dared to question our fearless producer, Sam Van Halgren. And, you know, based on the responses, everyone had a lot of fun with his question. Sam, I'll apologize to you on air, but not via email. This is what you're getting. I'm sorry. It was a good poll.
And he
question.
Doesn't really mean it unless it's in an email.
Exactly. Dave C. in Rochester, New York says, when the machines become self-aware, I believe that our robot overlords will be benevolent. That not only rules out the Matrix and Terminator scenario, but also neatly describes WALL-E, where machines tend to our every need. If you think of the Earth being overrun by garbage as shorthand for Earth becoming inhospitable due to mankind's environmental carelessness, Wally's vision of the future seems quite plausible and earns my vote.
It's all going to work out for Dave C. He's going to have his own personal Wally robot. He'll be just fine. John Nordyke in Corvallis, Washington said, "So many depressing ways to die or suffer whilst dying. I suppose Waterworld and Mad Max are somewhat the same movie, one with sand, the other with water, although Mad Max was a good film. Being suffocated by garbage and being nuked sound terrible, too. Alas, I return to female infertility. Sign me up for that. It doesn't sound painful or suffocating."
We also got these from Max O'Connell in Syracuse, New York, and Jeff. And Max is becoming a regular here on Film Spotting. We can't have poll comments without Max's thoughts. He says, "I voted for Planet of the Apes solely so I could yell, 'You maniacs!' at everyone who's not voting for it." And Jeff says, "I think you've missed the obvious apocalyptic result as foreseen by film, Idiocracy. Anticlimactic, maybe, but the film sadly becomes less a product of its time as we slide further towards its prophecy."
"I would agree with Jeff," says Kathleen, "if not for a technicality. I see Idiocracy as a very possible future for us, but not necessarily our end. As far as Earth becoming too polluted with garbage to be habitable, we all know that humans would shoot the garbage off into space before launching themselves. While a Mad Max scenario would be pretty cool, I personally see us ruining the planet before we ever run out of gasoline. I'm just plain too terrified of sentient machines and damn dirty apes to even consider those possibilities, and the human reproductive system is almost too prolific to be stopped, so I have to go with the ice caps. I think a combination of too much human reproduction, too much gasoline usage by too many machines, and us just plain getting dumber would lead to a natural catastrophe that we wouldn't be able to stop. That being said, I really shudder at the thought of drinking urine."
Well, I think Kathy has the right answer here, Josh. If I could go back now and amend the poll and add an other, I think Kathy nailed it. Bird, swine, ape, donkey, or some spillover flu is definitely the correct answer. Contagion.
Oh, yeah.
And probably any day now. Hard to argue with.
I think she's onto something.
Kathy is probably onto something. And I do want to take just a moment there to credit our buddy there, Max O'Connell from Syracuse, New York, the only listener who followed our instructions on a recent show where we asked to please include your location. We don't like just your names. We want to know where you're from. So thank you, Max, for doing that. And thank you to two more comments we have here and the experts who wrote these thoughts. These people actually, Josh, they decided, you know what, this may all just be fun and games, but we've got some actual perspective on this. And here it is.
Eileen says she's currently working as a civil engineer in the power industry, but one year I was an intern at a materials recovery facility and landfill, the largest active landfill in America. Seeing the tons of trash, there was a 13,000-ton limit, she says, come in daily, and the plans for a new mega landfill because our landfill was almost at full capacity opened my eyes to a lot of sad truths. For that reason alone, I had to vote for the Wall-E scenario, but hey, the Kevin Costner world could happen too.
And finally, Ben H. says, I thought I should just mention that even if we managed to melt every inch of ice on the planet, the water would never reach high enough to cover the entire Earth, a la Waterworld. Check out the big brains on Ben. Not saying the impact wouldn't be intense, just saying that there will still be places of dry land. You may just want to start investing in beachfront property on the Appalachian Mountains.
I don't know. So I'm going to have to see some charts and graphs, Ben, before I buy that.
Oh, I bet he could send them to us. Thank you to everyone who participated in that poll and had some fun with us with your comments. That does bring us to our summer theme question. And we mentioned Adventureland in that clip and Prince Avalanche, which is set back in the summer of 1988. So these are nostalgia films. These are movies about summer's past. And that got us thinking about summer movies and which one best reflects your memories of summer. I love this. We're going to get to know our listeners really well here, a little deeper, get some more insight into them, or maybe they'll just lie because they don't want to tell us the truth. They're going to tell us the answer.
The summer they want wished they had.
Exactly. We'll see how that comes out in the results and the comments. But Josh, the options are
Adventureland, Dazed and Confused, Dirty Dancing, Stand By Me, National Lampoon's Vacation, or Wet Hot American Summer.
Okay, so we have been putting off answering these questions in recent weeks. We didn't want to sway people in how they may vote. But since everyone should answer this one totally truthfully,
yeah, this is personal. So
we can't sway anyone's answer unless they want to be just as cool as one of us. Which
I'm sure that'll happen.
Really troubling on so many levels. So, Josh, I now do ask you, which one of those movies best reflects your memories of summer?
I think I confessed that National Lampoon's European Vacation, it felt very true to me, to my own family trip when I was a kid to Europe. So to follow that through, I'm going to have to say National Lampoon's
Vacation.
Now, are
you more of a Russ or an Audrey?
Who wants to be Russ?
Good point. Well, for me, I mean, it's definitely Dirty Dancing. I mean, when I get out on the dance floor and I'm seducing teenage girls. I mean, that's what my summer was.
Your life?
That was my life for many, many a summer. But really, I would say, considering I did spend a summer once working at Adventureland, a place called Adventureland in Iowa, and I also did spend every summer at least going once to Adventureland from the time I was 5 until I was about 18.
Sounds like a no-brainer.
It's a no-brainer. That's what I'm going with, though I wish I could say Dazed and Confused. It seemed like they were having a lot of fun. We want to know what you think. We want to know who you really were in your childhood and your teen years. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. That's also the location where you can get all the information you need about how to access our bonus content, which we do bring to you pretty regularly here on the show. If you have the Film Spotting app for iPhone, Android, or now for the Windows 8 phone, it does give you that little extra audio that we offer you. And we like to get into a lot of listener feedback in that bonus content. And I think our plan this week, Josh, I've pulled a little bit of top 5 movie robots feedback. I also pulled one email on each side of the Pacific Rim.
Oh, that was generous of you.
Each side of the debate. I went through them. I think I found the one that best makes your case.
You desperately searched for some support for me. I appreciate that.
There were a couple. There were a couple defending your take on that, Josh. And in fact, the one defending you is by far the more inflammatory and sarcastic. So I think you'll probably
enjoy. How about
that? Yeah. If you want to get that bonus content, again, just go to filmspotting.net and click on apps at the top of the page.
What about, like, ex-boyfriends? Say, we need an ex-boyfriend in there.
No, I don't have
Who's, like, an ex-boyfriend that just, like, really pissed you off, that you just, that just, like, you hated? And if they're just, like...
I don't have an ex-boyfriend.
What?
Yeah.
You don't have a single... You're 17 years old. You don't have an ex-boyfriend?
No.
Really?
Sutter, guys don't look at me
shocking.
Like that.
That's shocking. Yeah, absolutely, guys look at you like
no,
that.
No, no,
I just saw two guys looking at you like that. Eric Wolf and Cody Dennis
were
100% hitting on you.
No, we were just talking. They were 100%. Not hitting on me. No, no, there's absolutely
yes,
no way.
Why don't you think they were hitting on you?
Because I'm just, they weren't.
Because you're what? Amy, you're absolutely beautiful.
Oh my God, no.
That's a clip from the new film out now in select cities, The Spectacular Now. It stars Shailene Woodley from The Descendants and also my guy Miles Teller, an actor I really like a lot. Going back to the John Cameron Mitchell film Rabbit Hole, and also more recently, I hated the film Footloose, but he's really good in that movie and he's great in other roles as well. It's a love story from what I know about the film. I haven't had a chance to see it yet, but he plays a high school senior who meets this kind of nice girl and he's maybe not so nice a boy, and hence we get romance and also conflict. Josh, you have seen it, and I've been lamenting how many movies are out right now that I wish I could make time to go see. It's very hard, but there are like 6 or 7 movies.
It's gotten really busy all of a sudden.
Yeah,
with good stuff.
But there's a lot I want to see, including a lot of movies on demand I haven't had a chance to catch up with. So I'm behind. I'm still behind on The Spectacular Now, but I know it's been getting some good buzz. I know a lot of critics I trust have been giving it positive reviews. You've also been giving it positive reviews. So with that...
You wouldn't be asking me if it was just me, is what you're telling me.
Maybe.
You just dismiss that.
So I want to hear your thoughts on this film. Share with our audience whether or not this is one of those summer movies they need to make time for.
Yeah, and you should too. I mean, especially if you like Teller that well, because he's a standout here. This was really my first exposure to him. And you're right that that element, the romance between his character and Woodley's, is there. And that's certainly how they're marketing and selling this film. But it's not predominantly a teen romance. At least that's not how it registered to me. It was really a precise character portrait of a particular kind of high schooler. And, you know, these high school movies, the ones that really connect with us are the ones that get one thing about that experience so right that we're just hooked in. You know, we're like, oh, I know that kid, or I was that kid. And the kid here, Sutter Keeley, that Teller plays, is one of those. Everyone loves him. He's not really the class clown. I mean, he's got the girlfriend too. He's not the jock though. He's the party guy. You know, you invite him and all of a sudden you've got a party. But sometimes kids like that, senior year is the top of the line for them. And the distinction is going to be whether they can see a future beyond that for themselves and figure out how to work towards it, or whether they are just happy where they're at. And this kid, he even makes statements like that. He's got everything he needs. Life is great. And this movie captures how even those kids around him who used to laugh when he would say something like that heartily, maybe freshman, sophomore, junior year, in senior year, their laughter is a little bit more hollow because they've got college plans or they've moved on from their girlfriend to someone who's a little more promise. And Teller is so good at capturing this sort of kid because he's got that charm instantaneously. I mean, he bursts out of the gate in this movie and you're just like, oh, I know why everyone wants to be around him. But there are other layers to it, because what happens as it goes on is you watch this, and it's really poignant. You watch this dawning come upon him that, okay, I'm going to get left behind here, and to the point where he's going to have to make a choice. Now, what do I do? And I really did like this movie. I could go on and on more about it. It's also very distinctive in the fact that it portrays, and I don't think this gives too much away because they show it pretty early on, a teenager who drinks but who's also an alcoholic. And I don't know how many, and this is also the Teller character, how many teen movies look at teen partying that way. It's not a lesson or a condemning thing. It's just a crucial part of his character, but it goes beyond the fact that he does this to party, to that it echoes his worldview. He lives for the now, he lives for the moment, and, you know, drinking is pushing away the next morning, the next day, and he's sort of pushing away his entire future. So just really precise film, worth checking out.
I can't wait to see it. That's Spectacular Now. It is out now in limited release, including playing in a couple theaters right here in Chicago.
All right, our list of dangerous movie missions are up next. I just changed my number one, Adam. It's going to be trying to convince you that Elysium is any good.
Oh, that is dangerous.
The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
In the Bible, we are told God gave Moses in the days of old 10 great commandments for his people to hold true. The greatest commandment of all is in the book of Luke, as I recall. Do unto others as you would have them do to you. Do unto others as you would have them.
Thank you time here on the show as we take a moment to express our gratitude to all of our listeners who took some time this past week to go to filmspotting.net, go to PayPal, and donate some of their hard-earned money our way in support of the show. It really does keep us doing what we're doing. We also did get another batch of really interesting, really nice listener comments. We do start with a new gold-level donor, Josh.
That would be Stuart Van Eisden from Brunswick, Victoria, Australia.
And Stuart, it just now occurs to me, send us a really, really, really long note, a full-on diatribe aimed at you, Josh, for steering him wrong and making him look bad because he told all his friends that we have to go see Leviathan, the documentary, your number one film of the year so far. And let's just say they'll never listen to him again.
Come on.
And he didn't like it either.
Okay, I'm putting that on Stuart. I mean, you kind of have to. That's a very specific type of film. You've got to know your friends.
No, he just trusted your judgment. You said it was number one,
Stuart,
and you went.
That's not, my judgment is not nearly enough. I apologize.
We may feature a few comments from that great email on next week's show. I apologize, Stuart. I meant to pull them. We won't go into the full-on rant against Josh, but
oh, man.
He also had some nice things to say. So thank you, Stuart, for that great donation and for your comments. We also have some new $5 a month donors, Renato in Valparaiso, Indiana, and Andy in Madison, Wisconsin.
To the show that has taken so little and given so much, the majority of my 200-plus film queue is almost solely thanks to this show. I won't waste your time with my controversial opinion on the latest Malick film. That's Josh's job. I will instead simply say thanks for the literal years, guys.
When I first read that, I thought, well, he's wrong. I'm the one with the controversial opinion on Malick. I really didn't like that movie at all.
To the Wonder you're talking about?
But I then did go to Metacritic, and most people were kind of a mixed bag on it. So
yeah,
I guess,
what am I being controversial about? Not liking it. Oh, well.
I think that's what he's suggesting.
Maybe, I guess. It's a little out of the norm. I don't know how controversial
it is. I disliked it a lot more than a lot of critics did. But, Josh, you are often the controversial one here, so we'll run
with it.
We also heard from Don Polvorosa in Martinez, California.
My husband, Frank Reichert, will be celebrating his 52nd birthday on August 23rd. I've just made a monthly donation as part of his birthday gift because your show is a year-round gift for both of us. We've been listening for a few years, and the Film Spotting Podcast is the most anxiously awaited podcast of the week. Frank teaches a film and lit class at Alhambra High in Martinez, California, and supplements lesson plans with movie suggestions and information from your show. His favorite part of the class is to have the students list their top 10 favorite movies at the beginning of the year, and then redo the list at the end of the year. The beginning of the year list is fairly pedestrian, but the end of the year list will show signs of expanded movie tastes. It is such a pleasure to listen to an informed discussion about movies. I must add that Massacre Theater has become quite competitive since Josh came on board, and we are hearing an improved quality in the acting. We have recently lost our local theater that showed independent and art house films, and Dawn will provide the link you gave us about this on the show's site. So now we are even more dependent on your show and streaming video on sites like Fandor. Thank you so much for bringing us an engaging program every week.
What a nice note. Thank you, Don, and happy birthday, Frank. A little knowledge can be a very dangerous thing, Josh. I think that example we heard there, that story about the class he teaches and that
that's a great idea
project
with
he gives them is beautiful because you're right. You're going to ask a bunch of people who have never really thought about film in any kind of academic way, really don't know the language at all, and say, what are your 10 favorite movies? And they might be 15, 16, 17 years old. You're probably going to get a lot of very generic, popular films of the time type choices. By the end, if Frank's done his job, and it sounds like he is, those lists are going to change and maybe be a little bit more refined. So thank you, Frank, for including us in your lesson plans. We do appreciate it. We also have a new Buck a Show donor. His name is Orion Poberski. How great a name is that? He's stationed in Norfolk, Virginia.
Well, I started with episode 420 and ended with your most recent episode, 454. After 34 episodes listened to since I returned from deployment in April 2013, I've become addicted. I love Adam and Josh's dynamic, and Michael Phillips' occasional appearance is also a pleasure. After so much time invested in listening, I feel it's time to pay the dealer. Please accept my humble donation of a buck a show listen to. Oh, I also have to give a shout out to your benefactors at WBEZ for allowing you to exist and providing me with one-third of the podcasts I listen to. If it wasn't for your advertising on the other shows, I wouldn't have found you.
Well, it is true. We'd still exist without WBEZ. We just wouldn't
be on
the radio.
We wouldn't disappear.
No, we wouldn't disappear. The show would still appear.
Okay.
We did start as a podcast before WBEZ brought us on board. But it's nice to hear from Orion that he picked us up because he was listening, it turns out, to Sound Opinions, a great show here hosted by Jim DeRogatis and Greg Kot. It's kind of the music version of Film Spotting, though the structure is very different than our show, and they're great critics, and we did advertise. We had a little bit of a partnership where we promoted them, they promoted us, and it's nice to see that there's some crossover. So thank you, Orion, for your donation and that note. We get to a Silver Club donation here from Danny Yao in Sydney, Australia.
Your Woody Allen show finally made me stump up and pay the dealer. I run the Woody Allen fan site, Woody Allen Pages. We'll also provide a link to that. And we have been covering Blue Jasmine for over a year now. We are now trying our best to cover the production of Allen's next film with Colin Firth and Emma Stone. I've been a fan of Film Spotting for around a year and recently caught up completely. Without three or four shows a week, I finally decided to plunge into SVU from the start.
That's great to hear. I just hope that Danny still feels good about his donation and isn't going to retract and demand a refund after hearing our less than glowing review of Blue Jasmine. This came in before that.
That's what I was wondering.
Yeah.
When did this? Otherwise, he's a very gracious man.
He did
this
write
Danny.
Back and he said, I haven't heard it yet. Spoiler alert.
Oh, no.
But sorry, Danny, for that. And thank
you. It was fun while we had you.
For your support, absolutely. Maybe the next Woody Allen film will go down a little more smoothly. A few more picks here. How about this, Josh? I hope I'm going to say this right. Mindaugas in Vilnius, Lithuania.
I can confirm that's exactly right.
Uh-huh. Vilnius is the capital and largest city in Lithuania, and I did a search of the Film Spotting Gmail mailbag. Goes back to when we started as Film Spotting. That name took effect in 2007 sometime, maybe even a little bit before. and there is no reference to any listener prior to Mindaugas from Lithuania. No emails, no donations, nothing. I think that's our first.
He's the first. That's great.
We also heard from Duncan in London, and he's got a note.
Thanks for keeping doing what you're doing. I found so many films through your auspices and am really looking forward to the Korean auteurs. I'm producing a screening of two classic horror films in a former Victorian asylum in Peckham, London, where I call my home. I hope he doesn't mean the asylum. If you could give a shout out to your listeners over the pond to attend before the event takes place on the 1st of September, that would be brilliant. I think both films, Hausu and Haksan, would really appeal to your audience, and it's an incredible venue with cheap tickets.
So all of our listeners there across the pond, if you're in London and that sounds like fun to you, that's an event there on the 1st of September, a double feature of those two horror films, Haksan. Of those two horror films, I have to say Haksan, I have no idea if I'm pronouncing it right, completely new to me from this email, but according to what I found online, it's a 1922 Swedish/Danish silent horror film that was written and directed by Benjamin Christensen. So that's all I need to hear, 1922 Swedish-Danish horror film, silent horror film, no less. But then Hausu, or House, is a pretty well-known cult classic Japanese horror film from Obayashi. And this is a movie, I'll admit, I only know about. I discovered it about 3 years ago. Haven't seen it, but I discovered it about 3 years ago through friend of the show, Sam Smith, who now is working for The Dissolve, or The Dissolve has him doing some projects. He does a lot of cover art. He does great cover art for the Criterion Collection, and he has a weekly feature on The Dissolve where he...
Original poster.
Yeah,
art, right?
Writes about the original posters that he creates for movies. He's a really brilliant guy, and I am happy to call him a friend of mine and a friend of the show now. He did a poster for House when it was playing at the Belcourt Theater down in Nashville, their art house theater, and it became really popular. The poster sold out. A lot of people saw it online. It started to get a lot of attention, and Janus Films, who had picked up the movie, has the rights to it. They actually took Sam's design as the official movie poster for the limited re-release of the film. So congrats to Sam on that, even though it's kind of old news at this point. But that's House, and it is one I do need to see. I only know about it from what Sam said, and it sounds absolutely insane. Thanks again to everyone who donated and sent in those kind words this week. A quick note about our music this week. You are hearing the sounds of Billy Bragg, the English folk singer and noted left-wing activist. Probably a fine companion, in theory anyway, to the socialist sensibility somewhat on display in Elysium.
I'm just trying to imagine that on the soundtrack to the film, how that might have worked.
Yeah,
not too good.
Probably not. You heard the songs Tomorrow's Going to Be Another Day and Do Unto Others from his 2013 album, Tooth and Nail. We also want to throw out a quick plug for our buddy Jeff Goldsmith and his podcast, The Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith. You can hear his great interviews with screenwriters there. Just find the show by doing a search in iTunes, or there's a link in the notes for this show at filmspotting.net.
So just lift up your eyes, don't pass by on the other side, don't be bound by what you think of this me. Just a little bit of faith.
Hey there, Film Spotting listeners. Matt Singer here from the Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit podcast to tell you about our latest episode, in which Allison Wilmore and I brawl and then hug things out, women's minimum security prison style, with our discussion of the Netflix original series, Orange is the New Black.
And inspired by the series, we're going to recommend some prison movies available on different streaming sites around the web, like Hulu, Netflix, Amazon, and more. To listen, you can subscribe to the show in iTunes or go to filmspottingsvu.com.
First you trade the Cadillac for a microphone. Then you lie to me about the band. Now you're going to put me right back in the joint.
They're not going to catch us. We're on a mission from God.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. I do hate to be predictable sometimes, but you had to know that as we were going into a segment on our top five dangerous missions, that we were going to play that clip from the Blues Brothers, We're on a Mission from God. Though we did reference Apocalypse Now at the top of the show, that great line, I wanted a mission, and for my sins they gave me one. That could have just as easily been played there. Apocalypse Now, alas, will not make our list, even though we both love that film, because it's in the Film Spotting Pantheon. And there are a lot of movies in the Film Spotting Pantheon that do qualify for this dangerous missions. Obviously, any of the Star Wars movies probably fit as well. So there's some great titles there that we do love that aren't eligible for the top five. If you're fairly new to the show and you aren't sure what films are on the Film Spotting Pantheon list, go to filmspotting.net and click on top fives, and you'll find a link there. Before we get to your number five, Josh, why don't you set up your criteria for this list. Was this a tough one to put together?
Yeah, because it's not just Pantheon films. It's films in general that could apply under this category, Dangerous Mission. So Sam Van Hogren set up a couple restrictions for us that I followed that did help. He suggested no war movies, mm-hmm. no heist movies, no rescues. Basically, it shouldn't be something that was assigned to you, but something you took on as your own. So
okay.
I followed those. Mostly, there's one pick. We can talk a little bit about whether or not that makes sense. And then because we did tie this to Elysium, I used the character Matt Damon plays, his mission, as sort of a model where there's this protagonist, or it could be a group of protagonists, who are setting out to achieve this specific, very unlikely and risky goal.
Yeah. So we're on exactly the same page. And I'm glad you mentioned Elysium, the movie we did discuss in the opening segment, because that was the inspiration for this top five Dangerous Missions. And it was tough because so many films qualify as missions. So you do start thinking, well, do we have to leave out war movies? Okay, if we do, then The Dirty Dozen is out, and so many others. You mentioned escape films, but revenge movies oftentimes are about people on a singular mission. Detective movies as well, trying to solve a case in some way, are like missions. I thought of even a movie like Die Hard, where you could argue in a way that John McClane's on a mission to save his wife and free all these hostages from the terrorists slash thieves, whatever Hans Gruber and his company are. But that isn't something, as you suggested, Josh, that he took on at the beginning of the film. It was thrust upon him, but it wasn't a case where he had to have that moment where he said, I'm going to take this mission, and there's this clear set objective at the end of it. So that's something I did think about. You can get to the end of these picks, the end of these movies, and ask the question, did they fail or did they succeed? And there is, I think, a black and white answer to it. And their lives did have to be in constant danger. We're going to call them dangerous missions. They had to have a threat throughout. So with all those challenges, I also had the added challenge of not including some films that are go-to movies for me on top five lists. A movie like Fitzcarraldo, the Werner Herzog film, where a guy sets out to build an opera house in the jungle. You want to talk about dangerous missions? That one qualifies. I guess it'll just have to be an honorable mention for me. So now that we've thrown out all the caveats, what's your number five?
I'm going to start small with number five. This isn't like Elysium in that the mission isn't going to save the world or the universe. Instead, it's one woman's real-world mission to save her husband. This is A Mighty Heart, the 2007 film.
Michael Winterbottom.
Yes, exactly. Angelina Jolie was the star, and she played Marianne Pearl, whose journalist husband was kidnapped by extremists in Pakistan in 2002. Now, Pearl was a journalist herself, so she sets out to try to find him using her own investigative skills. And there's some danger in that, in the sense that she's here in Pakistan, too. These groups are still surrounding her, sending threats. And so it's a very dangerous environment that she finds herself in. She persists. Even the cooperation she gets with the local law enforcement, you're not quite sure how that fits in, and you have the American interests coming in as well. So there are a lot of layers here. Now, Jolie is very good. I think she does. Obviously, this is a different sort of role for her. I think she's good in it, but she's very much helped by Winterbottom, by her director, in subtle ways. I think his contributions are the reason her performance works. Overall, he brings this documentary-like, it's a procedural style, really, that the movie has. So it scuffs away any sense that this is going to be some sort of noble vanity project mm-hmm. or an Oscar bid, which maybe you think when you hear that Jolie is involved that it might become. It's never inflated in that way at all. This is a very quiet film in that sense. It's sparse, still gripping, this drama that's, you know, it's rooted in recent headlines. So it has that immediacy going for it already. And Winterbottom kind of lets that carry him through and doesn't try to inflate anything. A really good example of this, I think, is Jolie's big breakdown scene.
Marianne. I'm sorry. Danny didn't make it.
What's interesting is how Winterbottom handles it, because she goes Oscar bait. She goes big and huge. She goes for broke. But his camera, if you'll notice it, it holds back. Mm-hmm. It even cuts away at times. And at one point, it watches her. It gives her mostly silhouette. So I don't know. Maybe I'm not giving her enough credit here. I don't know what the collaboration was there. But it certainly works together so that they bring this nice balance, I think, to the overall movie. She has that emotional intensity, and then he's got this journalistic observance. And I like how it works together.
It's a tough movie to watch. It's an emotional movie and a powerful movie, but a very good one. And I guess a quick plug for our archives, if you want to go to filmspotting.net and click on interviews, I had a chance to interview Michael Winterbottom about that film.
Nice.
Here in Chicago. So it was a fun conversation with him, obviously a filmmaker I have a lot of respect for. My number five pick is maybe going to be a little bit of a surprise. I'm taking a page from the family-friendly Josh Larson playbook. It's a movie I'm positive I've never put on a top five in the entire history of the show, and it deserves to be because it's a great film, the 1979 Muppet Movie.
Oh, I love it.
You guys okay?
Why are you hopping up and down?
Because I'm hopping mad.
Guy's got a sense of humor.
Hey, why don't you join us?
Where are you going?
We're following our dream.
Really? I have a dream too.
Huh?
But you'll think it's stupid.
No, tell us.
Well, I want to go to Bombay, India and become a movie star.
You don't go to Bombay to become a movie star. You go where we're going, Hollywood.
Sure, if you want to do it the easy way.
We picked up a weirdo.
It's a film I watched again with my kids about 6 months ago who had never seen it, and it is just as much fun as I remember it. The hero, Kermit the Frog, of course, the mission, travel cross-country to Hollywood, break into showbiz, and, quote, make millions of people happy. The danger, maybe you think this is too safe of a pick, but Josh, there's some danger here. He has to evade the evil Doc Hopper who wants to force him to be the spokesman for his French fried frog legs restaurant chain, played wonderfully. Doc Hopper is by Charles Durning. And if you don't think that's dangerous enough, maybe you're forgetting the scene where Piggy is kidnapped and Mel Brooks tries to use the machine to brainwash Kermit. Or later, when Doc Hopper finally decides he's just had enough and he tries to kill Kermit. He hires an assassin.
Danger
and they
everywhere.
End up having a showdown where they're only saved in the end by one of Dr. Bunsen's Instagrow pills and Animal comes through for them. So there is a lot of danger here. I love all the cameos in this movie, even though they're very dated. And of course, my kids didn't know who any of these former celebrities
sure.
are. But the knowing winks at the audience, they all work. That's something I've always loved about the Muppet movies, that meta-ness where, you know, in this case, it's framed by they're watching a screening of the movie we're about to watch. That all works for adults. It works for kids, though, as well. My kids loved it, and I was really glad that I finally caught up with it after, honestly, probably 30 years it had been since I had seen the Muppet movie, but it's definitely worth seeing.
And I think it just came out on Blu-ray.
That's right.
A couple days ago,
yeah,
or maybe even today. So, yeah.
Go. A topical pick, the Muppet movie.
I love it. All right. Mine is not family friendly. My number four, even though I saw it quite a bit as a child, and we already heard from it, it's the Blues Brothers. The mission from God that Jake and Elwood Blues take on is to raise $5,000 needed to save the Catholic orphanage where they were raised. Their plan, a benefit concert with their former bandmates who have all wisely moved on. Now, this one, like the Muppet movie, maybe doesn't sound dangerous, but recall again what they do get themselves into: multiple run-ins with the police, assassination attempts by Carrie Fisher's jilted fiance, and of course those pesky Illinois Nazis.
Hey, what's going on?
Those bums won their court case, so they're marching today.
What bums?
The Nazi party.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Like I said, this came out in 1980 and I was six at the time, but it was a childhood staple for me. I'm thinking because of the Chicagoland setting, it must have been broadcast on WGN all the time, possibly. That sounds familiar. And also my neighborhood friend, my best friend on my block, he had older brothers and they basically just spoke in the dialogue of this film. So kind of just lived with it. Now, the movie holds up, as anyone who's watched it recently knows, and the music alone would guarantee that. You've got Ray Charles, you've got James Brown, a glorious Aretha Franklin. Yeah, I mean, this is a soundtrack I still listen to. The other thing I really like about the Blues Brothers is that it was a major studio comedy. I mean, John Belushi was big business at that time, but you look at this and it has a sense of anarchy and chaos that we associate with scruffy little indie comedies, raunchy comedies. And I think probably a lot of that has to do with the director, John Landis, who did Animal House with John Belushi. And the other thing I like is how amidst all this chaos, Belushi and Dan Aykroyd, their performances are almost opposite. They're like, they bring this zen serenity to their parts, despite all the insanity going on. Another thing that I didn't appreciate as a kid, but I kind of came to appreciate once I'd grown up and turned into this property tax paying adult, you've really got to admire how any movie generates this much suspense about paying a Cook County property tax bill.
Well said, Josh. A great film, obviously, the one, unlike you, I didn't grow up with at all. I don't know when I finally even saw it. I might have been in college before I saw the Blues Brothers all the way through.
Maybe it was a regional thing that it just was. I mean, I know it was a big hit.
Right.
So,
but I remember as a kid growing up in Iowa, we got WGN. I remember seeing it on TV quite a bit, but never really sitting down and taking it in. So good pick, though. Did have to be on this list. My number four, unlike the Muppet movie, is a film that, well, it's definitely not family friendly. And it has made one top five list and only one. Unfortunately, it was a recent one. But I have to pick it anyway. It's Sorcerer, the William Friedkin film from 1977. It made my top five Americans Abroad movies. So I've got the redundancy there, Josh, to regular listeners. It also subjects me, by bringing it up again, to the ridicule I may face for having to acknowledge once again that I haven't seen The Wages of Fear, the Clouseau film that inspired this film. Don't call it a remake. Friedkin will get very mad at you. But
okay,
it did
remember
inspire
that.
This movie, and I know I need to see it. But the reason I couldn't leave Sorcerer off this list was because I'm sure it's the only film on my list or yours where the mission is so dangerous that the actors were in just as much peril as the characters in the movie. The hero here is Roy Scheider's Jackie Scanlon. He's a former criminal, kind of a low-level criminal in New York City who has to exile himself to avoid the mob, and he ends up going to a remote South American country. His mission, in order to get out of that hellhole, is to make money by transporting highly unstable nitroglycerin 200-plus miles in a truck. The danger, probably don't have to say it, he's transporting highly unstable nitroglycerin over 200 miles, and over 200 miles of really rough terrain, bridges that no one should be driving on or even walking on, bad weather, and any kind of movement, anything that really bustles this nitroglycerin around could cause them to explode. So when you think about just pure tension in a film, knowing that they're driving at a slow speed and that any sudden movement could cause them to blow up, I'd call that tension. It is a very tense film. And as I referenced the making of this movie and what Friedkin put the actors through, I've talked about it a little bit before, but the scene lasts 12 minutes as they go over this really rickety bridge. And it looks like at any minute they might fall off. And Friedkin has suggested that there were times where the truck actually did overturn with them on it and they had to simulate the rain and it's pouring down on them. But that scene alone cost $3 million. And at one point, they had the bridge all built, and then they had to go to another location, rebuild the bridge. Then that location ended up with a drought, and they had to do all sorts of things to make it work in that scene. And as I said, $3 million just to get that done. And Friedkin told me when I interviewed him here in Chicago that if he had to go back and do it again, he would never put his actors in that much danger. That was a lesson he really learned from that film. It's a really grimy, dark, unsentimental movie that I think really tests an audience's ability to sympathize with or root for on any level some really, really bad people. And that's what Friedkin was good at for a while there in the 70s, was making those kind of movies and really forcing us into that kind of challenge as an audience. So I don't think Sorcerer is a masterpiece, maybe as much as some people do. I think I'd still definitely put The Exorcist and The French Connection and maybe one or two other Friedkin films ahead of it, but it's a really good film and perfect for this list.
All right, my number three, maybe the one that bends that no war movie rule a little bit. You'll have to let me know. It's Akira Kurosawa's 1958 adventure film, The Hidden Fortress. This does follow a general played by Toshiro Mifune who's trying to sneak across enemy territory. The dangerous mission here is that he's doing this with a princess, some gold, and these two bickering peasants. And here's where I have to insert the obligatory Star Wars reference,
yes,
because those peasants were, according to George Lucas, the model for C-3PO and R2-D2. I think The Hidden Fortress, though, it needs to be talked about less on Star Wars terms than its own, because this is an amazing movie. I know it's dismissed by some in the Kurosawa canon as an adventure film, a genre picture, but it has so much of his signature mastery in it, too. It has the orchestration of vast casts, the sly comedy, a lot of that has to do with those bickering peasants, and just these astonishing landscapes that stretch across the CinemaScope screen here. I'd probably recommend this actually as a starter film for Kurosawa if you haven't seen any of his pictures, because it does blend this artistry with the approachability of something that's like an adventure serial in a lot of ways, in its structure and its narrative. And once you see this, you know, you're definitely going to get a hunger for things like Seven Samurai, Yojimbo, or Rashomon, or even Ron.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're sharing our top five dangerous mission movies, and that's a really good pick, one I didn't consider. I like The Hidden Fortress, but I was one of those people, and maybe I just didn't give the film enough credit, and I need to go back and revisit it, but I was one of those people who saw it within that larger Kurosawa context, and I watched it specifically in the context of a Kurosawa marathon here on the show.
Okay.
And I had seen up to that point movies like Rashomon and Akira and Yojimbo, which I consider among the best films ever made and really profound films. And seeing something like The Hidden Fortress did seem slight to me in context of those other
movies.
In
context, yeah. If you're going to rank them, I'd probably agree.
Well, if you're going to cheat a little bit and have a little bit of a war movie as your number three, I can cheat and have more or less a heist movie as my number three, even though we did try to avoid those. It's the Christopher Nolan film Inception. Not only is it a heist movie, it's an espionage movie, it's a romance, it's a mindbender. It also takes on a lot of film noir elements. The hero, Cobb, played by Leo DiCaprio, his mission is to use some sort of bizarre technology to infiltrate the subconscious of this corporate target, this big businessman played by Ken Watanabe. Basically, they're going to get into his dreams, except it's layered and there's dreams within dreams within dreams, and you never quite know exactly what's happening, what's real, what is a dream. The danger, of course, of this mission is due to the sedation techniques they have to use and all those layers of the dreams. If you die during one of these missions, you're going to enter a sort of limbo, a purgatory. That's this dream space where you could be trapped forever and who knows what happens to you. So I don't know. That doesn't sound very good to me. It sounds like there's a little bit of danger there for Cobb and his crew. I don't know about you, Josh, how you perceive this movie. I don't know how you felt about it, but in the larger context of how it's viewed now, I know it got overwhelmingly positive reviews.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a lot of positive audience reaction, but I do feel like there was a backlash.
There was, definitely.
It's now maybe a little fashionable to rip on this movie, that it's not all it was cracked up to be, not as deep as maybe it should have been or wants to be or whatever. But like Memento, I've really only had two experiences where I've walked out of a movie and had this sort of extrasensory out-of-body experience because of what I just sat through for 2 hours. And the first one was Memento, the Christopher Nolan film. And then he pulled it off again with this movie, where you are sort of questioning your own reality as you walk out of the theater, trying to distinguish for yourself what's real and what isn't. I think it's nice when a movie can have that kind of impact on you.
Let me ask you a question. You never really remember the beginning of a dream, do you? You always wind up right in the middle of what's going on.
I guess, yeah.
So how did we end up here?
Well, we just came from the,
Think about it, Ariadne. How did you get here? Where are you right now?
We're dreaming?
You're actually in the middle of the workshop right now, sleeping. This is your first lesson in shared dreaming. Stay calm.
I do think visually, too, as you talk about the action scenes in this film, are really visually brilliant and conceived in a way that I think always does a good job of orienting you. You know where you are. You know where the characters are in the space. That's really important for me. I didn't care so much for the long snow chase sequence. I thought that became a little bit tedious, but overall those sequences are really wonderful, including the one with Joseph Gordon-Levitt, the famous one there in the elevator at the hotel. That is some really inspired camera work, and I think that they pulled everything off in a way where I remember the characters, the crew there, they talk about how, you know, you can't really take any shortcuts. You have to build this world and make it believable every step of the way, or else the person in the dream is going to realize they're having a dream and pull out of it, and it's bad for everybody involved. And I think that Nolan does a great job with his camera of making all those elements feel authentic and making us buy into the reality of what's a pretty crazy and absurd story, but somehow Inception works.
I'm with you. I think it's brilliant. It's very likely could be his best. Between that and The Dark Knight, I think, for me, I don't know what was behind the backlash. I mean, it was immensely popular, so sometimes I wonder if that comes into play once it's been embraced by the masses. I think there's this urge to kind of push back against that. And it might be that it is a puzzle movie, and I think sometimes when you revisit those, if you're not engaged in the puzzling action of it, it can seem like a lesser film, but I don't know that that's quite fair either. All right, number two, I think you said escape movies at the beginning, but I didn't know if Sam had put that restriction on it. So here's an escape movie.
Sure.
You can hold me to it if you want to. Chicken Run. It's Aardman Animation's first foray into feature filmmaking, actually, after their series of Wallace and Gromit shorts. It's a stop-motion riff on World War II POW pictures like The Great Escape, only here it involves a plucky hen, and she's voiced by Julie Sawalha, who tries to lead her fellow chickens off a farm with the help of this unreliable rooster, voiced by Mel Gibson. This is particularly well-suited to the art of stop-motion animation because it involves plans and gadgets and things that thrive on little details. All their escape attempts are full of these tiny touches. I really like the one where a bunch of chickens build this human figure out of sticks underneath a trench coat, and they get under there and hide and try to get out of the farm that way. This was a big hit, paved the way for Wallace and Gromit's own feature, The Curse of the Were-Rabbit, which is just as delightful. So if you haven't had a chance to see Chicken Run, check it out.
I know I have seen Chicken Run, and I know I liked it. I otherwise remember nothing about
really?
It. But I do know that I enjoyed that movie. I liked it more than the Were-Rabbit movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'd put it a little bit above Were-Rabbit, but like that one a lot, too.
All right. Well, for my number two, I did pick, I guess, a little bit of a detective story. We didn't completely rule those out. And I know I'm going to preface this to everyone out there who loves Hong Kong cinema. I know that there are other great Hong Kong films out there besides this one that I have brought up a fair amount over 8 or 9 years here on the show. But I really do love it. It's Infernal Affairs, the movie that inspired Scorsese's remake, The Departed, a few years ago. Our hero is a police officer named Chan, played by the great Tony Leung. His mission is to go undercover into the Triad. It's a crime syndicate, and discover who the mole on the police force is. And we probably don't need to spell out the danger. If he's discovered as a mole, as a police officer, he's clearly going to die. Along the way, even if he makes it out, he's going to face some physical abuse, and he's probably going to lose his sanity. We certainly see that play out a lot in Scorsese's version. Of course, you also have the opposite story going on in Infernal Affairs, where you have the Andy Lau character, who's from the Triad, infiltrating the police force to discover who their mole is. It's a film I have not seen in, I don't know, 7 or 8 years by this point, Josh, but I remember just absolutely being riveted by the cat and mouse game that Leung and Lau play. The tension of them trying to avoid being discovered, figure out who that other person is. I actually think the action scenes here, and some of them are pretty much replicated as they are, a couple of them, as they are in Infernal Affairs, we see him play out in The Departed. I think Infernal Affairs actually handles him better and in a more suspenseful way than even Scorsese does. I have not seen any of the sequels. They did make an Infernal Affairs 2 and 3, have not caught up with those. As much as I do love the first one, maybe at some point I will, but it's my number two.
You know what Infernal Affairs has that The Departed doesn't, and I do really like both films quite a bit, is this sense of the mythic to it somehow, mm-hmm. whereas Departed is a little more gritty, as you might expect from Scorsese. But yeah,
it's much more about masculinity.
Yeah. And both very good films, though. My number one is A Trip to the Moon. And this was thrown out there by the Film Spotting Advisory Board, actually, a group of listeners who donate their time and their suggestions when we put together lists like this. And when they put it up there, it made me realize that I thought I'd seen this thing, and I've never sat down and actually watched all 13 minutes. You know, you've just seen the famous bits here and there so much that it feels like you've watched it.
I thought it in a silent cinema class. We started with that probably.
Probably, yeah. That would make sense.
Yeah, it was actually a Silent Comedians, Chaplin and Keaton, but I think we had to start with the beginning.
Yeah, so I thought I better sit down and do this. So glad that I did. I mean, it's what a piece of magic. It's from 1902, of course, the silent fantasy. The director is Georges Méliès, and it envisions exactly what the title promises. This renegade astronomer, who's played by Méliès, he defies his colleagues' warnings and leads this rocket expedition to the moon. I talked about the importance of details in regard to the stop-motion animation of Chicken Run, and it's probably even more important here. Many of the films of this era were trying to document reality in a lot of ways, filming approaching trains and stuff like that. And this was creating fantasy out of rudimentary effects and stage tricks. I mean, Méliès does use a lot of in-camera effects. That's how we get the famous shot of the rocket landing in the eye of the man on the moon. But there are also so many background details to this. The spindly costumes of the aliens are just great. They look like these bizarre sort of skeleton bugs almost. And the painted cityscapes on the Earth scenes are even magical. I mean, you would think this would be notable for its space scenes, but even the Earth scenes are so mesmerizing. Somehow, at this one point, they get smoke, like physical smoke, to emit from what appear to be painted chimneys in the background. I just love getting lost in stuff like that. Now, as we say today, what matters is, you know, not necessarily the wow factor of the effects themselves, but how they do service the story at hand. And I think what happens in A Trip to the Moon is it all captures this sense of playful discovery, really. That's it's, you know, it's a dangerous mission, but it does feel playful here. And it's not only what's happening to the people on the screen, but you have to have this idea that it's probably what those audiences were experiencing at the very moment they were watching what was, you know, a newborn art form for them.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Magical is the right word for it. I think it's also the right word for my number one. It's Man on Wire, a documentary featuring the hero, Philippe Petit. His mission is to walk on a high wire between the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center. This is 1974 when he's attempting to pull this off. The danger is obvious. You're probably going to get arrested just trying to get up the towers, maybe hurt yourself along the way. If you do make it, of course, you're on a high wire over 1,000 feet above New York City. James Marsh directed the film, also directed a great recent doc called Project NIMH. I think he's a really, really talented documentary filmmaker. He has made narrative films as well. He uses rare footage. He uses reenactments and combines them with interviews to capture, I think, a sublime work of art, as I see it, Petit's stroll on that wire that is itself a sublime work of art. It was my favorite film of 2008. And if there are Film Spotting listeners who still haven't seen Man on Wire, this is one more push to get off the ledge and go ahead and take the leap and walk on that wire with Philippe Petit. It is such a sweet, inspiring, and fascinating film. That's Man on Wire, my number one. And those are our top five dangerous mission movies. What about honorable mentions, Josh? Any that were tough to omit from your list?
I thought about the Lord of the Rings trilogy, especially The Return of the King, which focuses more, although there are battles, of course, on Bilbo's mission to destroy the ring. Finding Nemo, I thought, could fall into this category. And we didn't put a restriction on spies, but it did feel to me a little bit to be its own genre. Otherwise, something like Hitchcock's Notorious might have made this list.
Yeah, I could see that. There are so many movies, as we've mentioned now multiple times, that could qualify as mission movies. And there's so many good ones that I'm not even sure why we should include any extra picks, because we're just going to get ourselves into trouble. But I'll mention two other films in addition to Fitzcarraldo: Escape from New York, the John Carpenter movie, and How Do You Have a Dangerous Missions List Without the Movie The Mission? Starring Jeremy Irons and Robert De Niro. You can send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter at filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Out in wide release this weekend, Jobs, the new film about Steve Jobs, the biopic starring Ashton Kutcher, the butler, or should we say Lee Daniels, the butler.
I think we're legally required to say Lee
Daniels,
the butler.
The director of Precious and The Paperboy, though we would then also have to say the full title of Precious. It's an account of notable 20th century events, all from the perspective of a White House butler, which maybe doesn't sound all that interesting, but that White House butler is played by Forest Whitaker, who is always an interesting actor to watch on screen. Kick-Ass 2 is out. Speaking of films I will never see, I'm sorry, I am prejudging it. I really didn't like the first Kick-Ass. Paranoia also out. Harrison Ford, Gary Oldman, Richard Dreyfuss, and Liam Hemsworth in that corporate intrigue thriller. Out in limited release, opening here in Chicago, Hannah Arendt. It's a biopic about the writer and political theorist. In a World, this is a movie I really want to see, Josh. Gotten a lot of good buzz. It's a comedy written by, directed by, and starring Lake Bell about voiceover actors. The Act of Killing, a movie that's come up recently.
This is the one I think we got to get out to somehow.
We definitely have to see it. It's about former, and I'm told here, unrepentant Indonesian death squad leaders who reenact mass killings in different cinematic genres. It sounds just chilling, but
and mind-boggling from what I've read about it.
Yeah, it really does sound fascinating. So that's one we hope to check out. We will definitely see Prince Avalanche, the new film from director David Gordon Green. It stars Paul Rudd and Emil Hirsch as highway road workers who spend the summer of 88 away from their city lives. And hopefully, some are suggesting, I haven't read any full reviews, but there's a line out there that says that this is a return to form for David Gordon Green from some of those silly comedies to
that would be nice.
The films like All the Real Girls and Undertow and George Washington. We'll see what's in store for us as we do see Prince Avalanche and talk about that film next week. And since Hirsch and Rudd are characters out on the road, out in nature, we're going to share our top five nature movies, movies where nature plays a key role, is essentially another character in the film. If you've got great ideas for that top five movies we shouldn't overlook, you can email them to us, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our featured music this week was from Billy Bragg, came from his latest album, Tooth and Nail. You can find out more at billybragg.co.uk. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.